This podcast is brought to you by Joy sponsor Pam Ann.
Hello, Melbourne. It's Pam Ann here. I'm so excited. I'm going to be touching down at the Comedy Theatre in August. See you soon. I love you, Melbourne. Mwah.
Set to land in Melbourne this August for two hilarious shows, Friday, August 24 and Saturday, August 25. Get your tickets now at ticketmaster.com.au.
Welcome to The Informer, Joy 94.9's nightly news and current affairs program, and your link to the stories that matter. We are committed to bringing you the day's most important news and current affairs stories from an LGBTI perspective. If it matters to the LGBTI community, we will cover it. We want to hear from you. Join the conversation, SMS 0427 Joy 949 or email on air at joy.org.au or follow us on Twitter at The Informer Joy.
It's Tuesday the 24th of April. Welcome to your nightly news and current affairs show, The Informer. I'm your host, Dean Arcuri. Tonight on the show, we look at what the Liberal Party proposed model for sex work in Victoria, the Nordic model, means for sex workers in Victoria. After Anzac Day dawn services tomorrow morning around the nation, rainbow wreaths will be laying to honour all servicemen and women who have served and currently serve. We discuss what this greater representation means. This week it came to light that members of the Liberal Party are proposing new party policy ahead of the state election to move from the current regulation in Victoria under the Sex Work Act of 1994 to what is known as the Nordic model. Under the Nordic model, while sex workers themselves are not specifically criminalised, clients and third parties such as landlords can be. Rachel Tyler-Jones spoke with Jane Green from the Vixen Collective, Victoria's peer-only sex worker organisation and the recognised representative organisation for sex workers in Victoria, about what this would mean for sex workers, as well as their clients and the wider community.
You'll often hear it referred to as the Swedish model, and its proponents often refer to it now as the Nordic model as well. It's a range of laws, often promoted as client criminalisation, and it does criminalise the clients of sex workers, but it also involves a wide range of other effects as well. And for sex workers, it significantly reduces the safety of our work. And it criminalises third parties. And what that means is not just clients, but other people that assist and manage our work. So owners of brothels, managers, receptionists, drivers, security, and other sex workers. And what I mean by other sex workers is sex workers that work together in small collectives or even pairs of sex workers can be prosecuted for pimping each other just because they've worked together. And also in Sweden, when it was introduced, sex workers could be evicted because landlords could be prosecuted for providing accommodation and premises that sex workers could work from. And obviously that had a significant effect because sex workers could be rendered homeless. It has the effect of preventing sex workers from advertising. It has the effect of increasing police surveillance of sex workers, and that has really significant impacts because when we talk about client criminalisation, police aren't psychic. They can't walk around and go, well, you're a client of a sex worker, therefore I'm going to arrest you. The way that they find sex workers' clients is by surveilling sex workers. And that means often that clients are much less likely to engage with sex workers in ways where we're able to screen clients and get clients to provide information that allows us to protect ourselves and engage in safety mechanisms. So clients aren't willing to give us personal information. They may only call sex workers with blocked numbers, and they may only be willing to meet us in locations that are remote and are public, rather than coming to see sex workers in locations that we control. So it really significantly impacts our safety. I'm Jane Green. I'm the spokesperson for Vixen Collective. Vixen Collective is Victoria's peer-only sex worker organisation. We are in our 13th year of operation as a completely volunteer, non-funded organisation, and Victoria is the only state or territory in Australia that does not have a funded peer sex worker organisation.
Now, obviously, this legislation has come out of Sweden. Which other countries have currently adopted the Swedish model?
Well, most recently France, and there's also been just very recently a report come out of France on the impacts on sex workers of the laws as they've been imposed in France. From France, the legislation was adopted on the 13th of April 2016. 88% of sex workers are against the criminalisation of clients. 63% of sex workers have experienced a deterioration of their living conditions. And I think that's really critical. 78% of sex workers have experienced a loss of income. And obviously when you're experiencing a loss of income, that impacts your life. It impacts everything about the way that you're able to conduct your life. And I think if anyone in any industry was experiencing a loss of income, it's not good.
Absolutely. Has France seen a drop in the number of sex workers using this model?
Overall, and including Sweden, the intent of these laws is to make sex work not exist. That is the very explicit intent of these laws. Under reports published by the Swedish government, by the Swedish police, there's been no proof that this has been the effect. And given that that's the intent, I think it's very telling that that hasn't played out in the evidence of these laws.
What alternative model would you rather see introduced in Victoria?
On a personal level as a sex worker, I'd like a model of sex work regulation that supports my human rights and critically supports my safety. And internationally, sex worker organisations and health and human rights bodies support the full decriminalisation of our work. And they support that model because it's played out in reality, both in New Zealand, where decriminalisation was put into place in 2003, and in New South Wales, where decriminalisation was put into place in 1995, as being a model that has supported our human rights and health and safety.
Are you able to talk a little bit more about the effects that they have seen in either New Zealand or New South Wales?
Well, I think it's important that for people that maybe have concerns about the impact of decriminalisation, and often people that are proponents of the Nordic model, are concerned that perhaps the size of the sex industry will increase, or that there may be impacts on things like trafficking. That under decriminalisation, there is proof over many, many years, because decriminalisation has been in place, for example, in New South Wales since 1995, that the size of the sex industry hasn't increased, that it's been static. That decriminalisation is a better model for the police to have a better access to the sex industry to detect cases of trafficking. That these things are better under that model, as well as supporting the rights and the safety of sex workers. And so when you're looking at all of these things across the board, decriminalisation is what is best for everyone.
Do you know if the motion that's been drafted by the Liberal Party to be debated was drafted in consultation with sex workers or sex worker advocacy groups?
Absolutely not.
And what are some of the concerns that sex workers or advocacy groups have around introducing policy that doesn't take into account their lived experience?
Well, I mean, to go back to your previous question, I think it's very common, and I know certainly in my experience, and I've been working as an advocate for community for many years now, government historically does not consult sex worker community on law reform and regulation. And I know from working with the National Pink, because Vixen Collective has worked with Scarlet Alliance on this matter, that neither of our organisations were consulted in regard to this, and we are the relevant organisations to be consulted. And it's a problem. Marginalised communities, not just sex workers, but many marginalised communities have policy formed about our lives without being spoken to. And we're very commonly spoken about and spoken over rather than spoken to regarding our lives. And it's not a problem that's just reserved for sex worker community. It's very common across the board. And it's essential. You can't make policy about people's lives without talking to them. And if you do, then you're infringing on their human rights. It's a matter of course. That's how it works. And it shouldn't be that way. The Liberals need to listen to our community, because we are the affected community. And it's appalling that legislation and policy can be made without listening to any affected community. And too often it happens in government, and it should never happen.
One of the reported concerns that's been sort of cited as a reason for putting this motion on the table is the perceived rise in the number of massage parlours offering erotic services in the suburbs. Could you maybe just speak to that and the way that the sex work industry is currently changing?
Well, I think we need to recognise the fact that in Victoria at the moment we have a licensing system, and licensing is a hostile system that, again, doesn't support sex workers' rights or safety, critically. And at the moment, the licensing regime is so difficult, both for individual sex workers and for sex work businesses, in terms of having substantial barriers to getting licences, that it doesn't encourage compliance. And when you don't encourage compliance, then businesses are not going to participate in the system. And there's been reports by Consumer Affairs Victoria, which is the regulatory body at present, that have basically said the same thing. Not only is compliance not encouraged, but the system itself will never cost equalise. That means that they're never going to take in fees through brothel licensing enough to pay for the administration of the system. The system is broken. It doesn't work from a bureaucratic standpoint, and it doesn't work in terms of ensuring the health and safety of members of our community. And our community has been telling government for decades that what they need to do to fix it is to implement full decriminalisation. I think critically is people often have this idea in their heads that full decriminalisation means no regulation, and it doesn't. It means that sex work is regulated and sex industry businesses are regulated like any other businesses, and sex work is like any other work. Now, from the point of view of individual sex workers, at the moment, street-based sex work is still criminalised, and obviously that has really severe impacts for street-based sex workers. For brothel-based sex workers at present, brothel-based sex workers don't have a good choice of a range of workplaces, and all sex workers in Victoria are subject to mandatory STI testing. Now, that forces us through one anonymous health clinic in the entire state. That's not acceptable. It doesn't give us good options in terms of managing our health. And no other workforce is treated in that way. And for private sex workers, we are forced to register with the state. It has the impact where essentially we have a criminal record when we're not criminals. It's a record that's held with Consumer Affairs and Business Licensing that can be accessed by the police and council and Consumer Affairs staff, and that can never be expunged. It's lifelong. And I'm just listing a few examples. None of those things make us safer. None of those things make us better off. And none of those things support our welfare or our human rights. Decriminalisation is important because decriminalisation supports our human rights and gives us the same rights as other workers. And that's the key thing. We're not asking for anything different or anything special or advantages. We're asking for the same thing that other workers get in Victoria. Not only have the Liberals put this up as a motion, but it's occurring in a space where the Victorian Greens are running a candidate for the seat of Richmond, which is Kathleen Knowlton, who has been a long-time proponent of the Swedish model. And in the context where the Victorian Greens and the Federal Greens, formally as their policies, support decriminalisation, and yet they're allowing a candidate who has very strong anti-sex work and pro-Swedish model views to run in that seat. And there is more than a decade's worth of sex worker protesting of that policy of running that candidate. I think it's important for people to note that there's been a number of motions in terms of the Liberal Party agenda for the state conference, including gay conversion therapy, which was taken off and defeated, that have been tremendously concerning. And I would also remind people that in Australia, greater than 60% of sex worker community is LGBTIQ. So the overlap between our communities is significant, and things that affect LGBTIQ community affect sex workers, and things that affect sex workers affect LGBTIQ community. And the Liberal Party has been awful to all of us in this agenda.
That was Jane Green from the Vixen Collective, the recognised representative organisation for sex workers in Victoria.
There is still more to come on Joy's The Informer, the news program from an LGBTI perspective.
Tomorrow is Anzac Day, a national day of remembrance in Australia and New Zealand that broadly commemorates all Australians and New Zealanders who have served and died in all wars, conflicts and peacekeeping operations, and the contribution and suffering of all those who have served. In dawn services around the country, people come together and pay their respects. And in the past few years, Anzac events have become increasingly inclusive of minority groups. After these services, rainbow wreaths are now laying to represent the diversity of those who have fallen. And Darcy Meehan spoke to Stuart Martin, the Victorian Coordinator for DEFCLIS, the Australian Defence LGBTI Information Service, about the importance of the rainbow wreaths.
We started laying a rainbow wreath, I'd say maybe 3-4 years ago, if my memory serves me correctly. It was something that was picked up in some research that Dr. Noah Reisman did. There was a group of Air Force people who tried to lay a wreath in early 1980s in Melbourne. And an odious little man called Bruce Ruxton, who was the state president of the RSL at that time, stopped them, actively interfered with them laying a wreath on Anzac Day. And Noah came across that, one of the people who organised that and tried to lay the wreath 3-4 years ago in one of his research projects. And it triggered in talking to Noah about that, what we could do from DefBliss, because we really hadn't looked at organising around and being at Anzac Day and laying a wreath and going to dawn service. A lot of us would go as individuals, but never as a group. I had the idea of saying, well, okay, how can we honour not only those four or so people who try to do in the early 80s, but how do we also honour and remember the multitude of LGBTI people who've served in silence for many years, right from, you know, the Boer War onwards. You'll hear people like Bruce Ruxin in the past making statements about there are no homosexuals in the military. Well, Patrick White, the famous Nobel Prize-winning Australian author, served in the Australian Air Force in the Second World War as an intelligence officer. So there's one clear example, but there are a multitude of people who served in silence. The laying the wreath was a visible sign for us to not only remember the actions of those four brave fathers who did in the past, but also becomes a enduring thing that we do as an organisation to subtly highlight the serving in silence of all those people who went before us. And it's a visual reminder, so hence the rainbow-coloured wreath. If you ever go to Anzac Day and see a cenotaph, you'll see wreaths, and they're all pretty much a standard colour and a standard design. We thought, how we best stand out subtly. We didn't want to make a fuss or a scene, but we felt, OK, how do we make that visible? And the rainbow wreath was that mechanism to do that. We have a gathering at most of the major capital cities at the cenotaph for dawn service, and that's quite an important thing for someone who's served in the military. And then we lay a wreath usually later on, so a couple of hours later, at the point where you can lay a wreath at the cenotaph. So each capital city has a slight different time span depending on how the design of the day is. We want to be subtle, reverent, and give people the opportunity to remember the sacrifice that went before them that was done in silence. It's about paying a debt back.
That's one of the things that I wanted to touch on, is a lack of acknowledgement. I've got a quote from Dan Dehaene, the Minister of Veteran Affairs, just talking about how women were acknowledged back in the day. He said many of the female veterans were observed that when they wore their medals in public, people assumed that they were wearing the medals of their father or their grandfather. Even though these people served, they weren't acknowledged as service members. Is it similar within the LGBT community with a lack of acknowledgement? People don't really perceive that community as a big part of the armed services.
Yeah, I think that's a fair comment to make. Because you're invisible, because you have to be invisible, because if you found out, in modern times you were kicked out. So those rules were less rigid during the First World War and the Second World War, when manpower was incredibly short. Shortcuts were taken officially. You could enlist at the younger age and people would just turn a blind eye if you were a strapping, fit young man, so to speak. Because of the severe shortage of men, gay and lesbian people did go off to war. And some of those people had very open relationships. And I use Patrick White as an example again. His long-standing partner, he met during the battle in Greece. And it was reasonably open that people knew his relationship. It's not to say that everyone had that ability. Once you came back to Australia after the war, if you were lucky to come back, most people settled down, got married and lived their life, and the war was became a memory. But for gay and lesbian people, it's much like the experience of a lot of Aboriginal experience when they served. They went back to a society that had not changed and had not accepted their service and validated their service and gave it due deference. You had to slip back into the shadows again because, being a homosexual was a dirty, foul, disgusting thing from people, some people's perspectives in society in those days. So it didn't matter that you'd risked your life to serve your country because you were seen as unworthy. And I think the analogy is better for, to draw that to what Aboriginals experienced and to some extent what women experienced when men came back from the war. They suddenly found that although they were highly skilled and very capable, suddenly they found themselves back home having children, not being able to continue the life they had led in the war and not being honoured for it, because I think this is the hyper-masculinity aspect. We don't trumpet that we're a warrior race, because I don't think we are, but at times it creeps in, the footy attitude, that sort of weird mateship that occurs in football teams. We focus on what males do, you know, male-dominated society. You know, we don't laud and laurel the efforts of women or minorities in this country very well because of that blokey culture we have. So those are the factors that affect why people aren't acknowledged. You know, there's been no apology offered by the ADF or the government for those people who were kicked out of the ADF for the sheer fact only that they were gay. And we need to remember that the laws of the land at the time, certainly towards the end of the military ban, was it was quite acceptable and legal to be gay in Australia, but you couldn't be gay in the military. So those things are things that need to be progressed and discussed in the future. But it was pretty difficult to come back from an environment where you're accepted to suddenly when you're not. And, you know, being open in the 1940s and 50s and 60s meant that you lost your job, meant that you lost your house, meant that your family didn't talk to you. And we know that occurs to some extent nowadays in society, but nowhere near as significantly and in sense of total destruction of your life somewhat.
This is The Informer, Joy 94.9's nightly news and current affairs program, and your link to the stories that matter.
We now continue our conversation with Stuart Martin, the Victorian Coordinator for DEFCLIS, the Australian Defence LGBTI Information Service, as we discuss dawn services and the importance of inclusive and respectful representation of all service people in the armed forces.
The issue around the wreath is that we're honouring the effort of four people in the 1980s, and we're making a public statement that, without shoving in people's faces, that gay and lesbian and transgender people have and do serve in the ADF, and they deserve the same recognition and reverence and respect and remembrance for that service. How we do that is we take part in the traditions of that we have in our society. You don't change society by coming in with a sledgehammer and cracking a walnut. Yes, you open a walnut, but you end up eating a squashed nut. It is much better to do it subtly and with regard and respect, because invariably you win the high moral ground and people understand and you educate and you lead. So that's what we're doing. It's a significant and important tradition to society to pay respects and reverence to people who went before us in war, because they made that ultimate sacrifice. So that's why we take part in that, because it is a military tradition, an Australian tradition, and laying a wreath is part of that, and we're just doing that subtly. We don't demand the right to march down the street at Anzac Day as a whole gay association. You know, we do that at Mardi Gras, and we are allowed by the ADF to march in uniform, and that's a significant achievement and concession by the ADF to allow us to do that, and we've been doing that for 5 years now. So how do we ensure that the work that's been done by DEFCLIS and by serving LGBTI members and the ADF is by doing the best that we can in our everyday life. Being gay and lesbian and transgender is not the sole identifier of who you are as a person. It is an aspect of your life. But it's about being proud about who we are, about saying we are no different to anyone else when it comes to doing our day-to-day job. Being gay or lesbian or transgender or intersex does not make you a superhuman being or make you any less a human being. It makes you a human being like everyone else. We all have different aspects. Be it, you know, you might be redheaded, you might have blue eyes, you might be left-handed. For us, it's about saying we're here, we do our job as well as anyone else, and we're proud to do it. And we support the ADF continuing ongoing efforts to make sure that we are able to serve and live in not only ADF in a welcomed, supported environment, but also in society in general. And we have a dawn service tomorrow morning, the 25th. So if you're interested and you've never been to a dawn service and you don't know what to expect, now's your chance to experience that if you haven't come from a military tradition. It is a very moving and solemn experience and only goes for maybe 45, 50 minutes. If you're interested and want to come along and want to make sure that you're with someone who can support you and you're not going to be left on your own, we will meet up at 5 a.m. at the Seasons Botanic Gardens Hotel on 348 St Kilda Road tomorrow morning at 5 a.m. I know that's very early, but dawn sort of cracks sort of around 5:30-ish onwards. So if you're there by 5, we can walk you through the, you know, you can share the experience with us and understand it. We would then lay a wreath at around 7:30 to 8 o'clock on Anzac Day morning. So if you want to just come to and take part in laying the wreath, if you can meet at the Eternal Flame, which is near the cenotaph off St. Kilda Road at 7:30, we'll allow about half an hour for people to get up, acknowledge it. Some people think 7:30 in the morning is very early as well. So we'll lay a wreath, and that'll take maybe 15 minutes of time. Again, you'll get to experience what it's like to lay a wreath, and you'll get the opportunity to talk to some current and previous serving ADF members to get an understanding of what the perspective is from our lives and get an understanding of it. So you're most welcome to come along. I know Globe's also trying to encourage its members to come and join in. And I know that, you know, a lot of people I know who have no military connections come along to a dawn service or would love to come to a wreath laying service. Now's your opportunity. We do it every year, but we do it in a safe and inclusive environment.
That was Stuart Martin from DEFCLIS, Australian Defence's LGBTI Information Service, supporting and representing Defence LGBTI personnel and their families.
This is The Informer on Joy 94.9.
That's it for another episode of The Informer, bringing you news and current affairs for Australia's LGBTI communities. A podcast of tonight's Informer will be available to download soon at joy.org.au or on your preferred podcast platform. Don't forget to follow us on social media at The Informer on Joy 94.9 on Facebook and at The Informer Joy on Twitter. If you have a story or tip you'd like to share with us, get in touch at theinformer@joy.org.au. You've been listening to The Informer on Joy 94.9. I'm Dean Arcuri.
This is The Informer on Joy 94.9.